Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Now it's time for our Friday gathering. This week I am joined by Fine Gael TD for Dublin Rathdown and Minister of State for International Development and the Diaspora, Neil Richmond, Social Democrat TD for Wicklow, spokesperson on transport, energy, agriculture and the environment, Jennifer Whitmore, Irish Times political correspondent, Harry McGee, and political editor with the Irish Examiner, Elaine Loughlin. Good morning, everybody. How are you all? Neil, can we start with the diplomacy around St. Patrick's Day, please? We're sending more senior ministers to the USA than to the whole of Asia and the whole of Australasia. Surely the only one that matters is the one that manages to get inside the Oval Office. And we should be seeking to spread our influence a little bit more evenly around the globe, shouldn't we?
Well, I think, firstly, it must be noted that it's the holy month of Ramadan, which means trade missions to certain parts of the Arab world just aren't a runner. And that was the same with last year. But in relation to the US, we've made it quite clear that we're putting an enhanced focus on the United States this year. And not just at a federal level, but also at a state level, because so many decisions, particularly economic decisions, are taken at a state level. And of course, we've thriving Irish diasporas of varying hues, which is under my brief, in cities we all know like New York and Boston and Chicago, but increasingly in other cities like Miami and Austin, where there's really growing economic links between Ireland and the US. Really, really important one. And we all know there's been a change of political administration there at a federal level. We have a new Irish government as well. Of course, we should put a new focus, but we're not ignoring the rest of the world. I'm going to Kenya and Tanzania.
But you're the only minister going anywhere in Africa. Well, and they're not all Muslim countries.
Well, actually, the Taoiseach, or the Taoiseach, is in South Africa next week for the G20. And because the G20 is happening, that has actually given us even more reasons to go to Africa this year, unlike other years. Yes, I'm going to Kenya and Tanzania for St. Patrick's Day. I'm also going to Sierra Leone and Liberia in April. Then I'm going to Malawi in May. Then I'm in South Africa for the G20, as well as visiting our aid missions, crucial one in Zambia, tied to US aid, and Zimbabwe in July as well. So it's all about balance. We don't do all our diplomacy on the 17th of March or the week around. We do a lot of it. It's a great welcome, a great open invitation, but every year is a little different. And this year, everyone agrees that with the new administration, the looming threat of tariffs, the impact already of tariffs on steel and aluminium, the risk to our own economy, and the very clear geopolitical concerns and the role the US will play, be it in Ukraine, as we saw overnight, or in the Middle East, it does require an enhanced focus.
Jennifer Whitmore, do the Social Democrats think that the Irish government should be lobbying for the invitation to the Oval Office on St. Patrick's Day, or should we just sit back and wait for it to come?
Oh, look, I think probably everyone in the country, every time Donald Trump opens his mouth and says anything in relation to international affairs, I certainly know my stomach takes a turn. It's very difficult to hear what he's saying now. He's advocating for ethnic cleansing in Palestine, for the forced displacement of an entire population. We can't ignore that. We can't pretend that he's not doing that. So I think if he was to continue on that same trajectory, our preference would be that we wouldn't go over. So certainly we wouldn't be lobbying to go over. I mean, my understanding is he hasn't actually even offered
We don't have an invitation. But you don't want them to go. Look, the reality of international diplomacy is that you don't get to negotiate solely with people that you respect and admire.
I think, look, Ireland has I think we have a very unique position in the world, and I think from our history, the fact that, I mean, anyone who's over in America, the majority are there because we were forcefully displaced from our own land, whether it was through the famine, or other events. And I think we need to recognise that, and I think we need to be true to that. We have a very unique place as a country, and we are a voice for peace. And I do think we need to use our position to express our dissent.
And you can only do that if you are in the room and getting FaceTime with Donald Trump, telling him what's what on Gaza, telling him what's what on tariffs.
And I don't think that would be how. I really do doubt that if the Taoiseach goes over, that he will be handing over the shamrock and also saying, hey, by the way, what you said about Gaza was disgraceful and completely irresponsible.
Neil Richmond,
there's no way he's going to be
doing
that.
She does have a point, doesn't she, that, you know, that particular little ceremony is not the occasion for any meaningful diplomacy. It's just a photo op.
But there's a lot more than that ceremony. And I think I actually remember the first year of Donald Trump's presidency, when Enda Kenny, as Taoiseach, went up and made a very strong speech in relation to immigration, very strong speech.
With Donald Trump standing right beside him.
With Donald Trump standing right beside him. So this notion that you just go over there and hand over a bowl of shamrock and it's only 30 minutes, let's be clear, there is very real meetings held, not just between the Taoiseach and the president of the most powerful country in the world, but also pretty much, I think there's 9 diplomatic missions going to the US covering a range of cities, including Washington, D.C., where we'll be meeting with governors, with state legislators, with senators, with congresspeople, with the Irish diaspora, with Irish business people based in the US. And we will be raising very clear points of concern in relation to the president's attitude, both towards the situation in the Middle East as well as Ukraine, and also our very clear economic interests.
Harry McGee, I'm going to steal a line that you would no doubt write on the 17th of March, if the meeting in the Oval Office does go ahead, and that it is that it would be an opportunity for Donald Trump to have to be forced to celebrate an undocumented migrant who was trafficked to these shores by a gang of people smugglers.
Yeah, that's a long enough sentence for the Irish Times for sure. Yes, it's a tricky one. I mean, Micheál Martin, I don't envy him his task if he does get an invite, and if he does go, you know, it will be like asking an elephant to perform a tightrope act with a blindfold on, because he's going to have to be very careful about how he treads across the room. I take Neil's point. I was in Washington last year, indeed as was Elaine when Leo Varadkar did his last trip as Taoiseach, and he used unstinting language in relation to Gaza and Israel. Now, perhaps Joe Biden would have been a slightly more receptive president than the current incumbent.
Obviously, it didn't work, though.
It didn't work, but he did make his point, you know, and Trump is transactional. You know, he says one thing, and we've seen him say so many things in the past few weeks, and you wonder, will there be follow-up in relation to his action? I think there is a material difference between 2016. In 2016, I think those who were surrounding him were what you might describe as kind of sensible people and adults in the room, and they weren't necessarily Trump loyalists. I think the change since then is that those around him are ideologues, and are at least some of them are as driven, if not more driven, than he is. The other thing that seems to be evident, in my view, is that the influence of the Irish America seems to have dwindled a little bit in relation to this regime compared to the last. There's no Mick Mulvaney, there's no really strong Irish Americans in key positions in this particular administration. So that's another challenge for the Irish. But I've no doubt that if the Taoiseach does go across, I think that he will have to say something. There will be a moral imperative on him to say something about Gaza and Israel, even if the person receiving it doesn't really want to hear it.
With the exception of saying something on Gaza and Israel, Elaine Loughlin, I wonder, might the more strategic or the more tactical thing to do to be to say as little as possible, leave as few hostages to fortune if Micheál Martin does get to sit down with Donald Trump? Mm-hmm. Because, as Harry says, after all, we have no idea how much of what he's saying he is going to make good on.
Yeah, and we've seen before that he has put out threats to different countries, whether it's Mexico, Canada, and then quickly rode back on them when he got an alternative. And in the case of Mexico, it was troops at the border that actually were probably going to happen regardless, but it was seen as a win for Trump. But I think while our stomachs may churn at the idea of an Irish leader going over to meet Trump this year especially, and we don't know what he might say in the next 24, 48 hours, let alone in the weeks that will come.
One wonders does he.
Exactly. But you have to remember, this is 4 years. There will be presidents after him. And this Shamrock ceremony dates back to 1953, actually, when it wasn't a Taoiseach who went over. It was our ambassador at the time, John Hearn, who met with President Eisenhower. So to give up on that dedicated day, and actually it's a series of days, and it's not just the White House ceremony, to give up that for one individual who will be there for 4 years, I think would be a mistake.
So hold our noses, play the longer game. Compromise ourselves.
I think once we lose that dedicated day in the White House, we're not going to get it back. We're a tiny, minuscule, inconsequential country in comparison to world leaders that I think any president would be more interested in meeting and having discussions with. So I think we do need to cling on to that. It may be slightly uncomfortable for the next 4 years, but you do have to think of the longer term. But you were right at the start where you mentioned the fact that we are sending so many to the United States this year, and even the Attorney General, Rosa Fanning, is going as well. And then you look at the biggest, our biggest trading partner in Asia, China, and we have James Brown going there, India as well. Massive capacity for expansion there and development, and only one minister again, James Lawless, going.
Yeah, okay, but as things stand currently, trade deficit, Irish trade deficit with the US, $87 billion. Trade with China, $5 billion.
But it's an economy that is growing, and it's a relationship that we have that is also growing. So if you're looking as well, and we are, we're talking about tariffs, and you spoke about it on the show earlier on, should we be looking elsewhere? Should we be refocusing our efforts to develop trade and economic ties with other countries and other nations around the world to protect us? Because realistically, we're not Cuba, we're not North Korea. We can't pull the shutters down and decide that we're going to go it alone and try fend for ourselves. We are an open economy, and we have thrived off that. But being very heavily reliant on both the US and to a lesser extent the UK and Europe could be very detrimental if you see what Trump has in store.
I think this is a really good point, Elaine. And I remember, because obviously I was across the Brexit brief, as we, and we all remember the worry and the concern that if the UK went WTO, what would that mean to our trading? And we did see that level of diversification, where we now have Germany, Belgium, our larger trading partners in the UK. When we joined the EEC, 55% of our exports went to the UK. It's under 10% now. We were able to manage that relationship, but crucially in the goods, all our cheddar cheese was going to the UK. Well, we actually worked with stakeholders, with companies on the ground in the UK and across the world to develop, be it baby formula, other dairy products. And that's what we're doing with the US now as well. Looking at the Irish-American community, we are a very important strategic partner. Ireland is the sixth largest investor in the US as well. So it is both ways. But we are looking around the world, and we look at the trade missions. Like, I'm going to Kenya, and it's not an Irish aid mission. There's €38 million of Irish exports going to Kenya this year. We can build that. We will build that. And that is the focus. But I think politically, the US does need extra attention this year.
I want to move us on, though, because events overnight and these moves on the Ukrainian front cast defence in Europe and in this country into a different light. Are the Irish public ready, Harry, do you think, for a big jump in defence spending?
I think we've, I think for 40 years, I think people kind of trotted out the slogan, almost like singing Fáil Na Gael an Lae, that we are a militarily neutral country, without really thinking deeply about what that actually means in a modern, more complicated and more fragmented world. There was a very good series of seminars that were conducted last year. It was last year or the year before, when Micheál Martin was Minister of Foreign Affairs. I attended them all. I thought they were absolutely fascinating. And they actually, and there were very strong views on either side about whether we should depart from it. You know, I find it very hard to actually understand what, you know, you hear politicians say we are militarily neutral, but we're not politically neutral. They're not kind of mutually exclusive. They're almost, there's a big overlap there. So sometimes it's very hard to define what neutrality actually means in the modern world. And the nature of, you know, we think about armies fighting each other across trenches or whatever. The nature of invasion has completely changed. For example, we're probably most vulnerable now via our kind of interconnectors, our communication channels, cyber attacks and what have you. And modern warfare is waged at that level. And we have to be in a position to be able to defend our infrastructure, and we may rely on others to do that.
Okay.
Does that foul the notion of military neutrality? I think, you know, our defence forces are under-resourced. I think we should have 9,600 members of our permanent defence force. I think we have 7,300 at the moment. We have to spend more on our defence just to bring us up to the status quo ante. But we also need to bolster our defence spending in the future to protect us. And then look at us then in the relationship of our the European Union and our relationships with our neighbouring countries without compromising military neutrality. But very complicated, but it has to be done in my estimation.
Neil Richmond, basically we're chancers. To find a Valentine's Day reference here, we want to go dancing, but we're not going to get dressed up.
Well, I think this government, and particularly the previous government, have acknowledged that we do need to spend more on defence, and we need to be able to have this discussion. You asked, Harry, are the Irish people ready for discussion? I think they absolutely are.
How much more do we need to spend on defence? Currently, it's 0.2% of GDP, where most European countries would at least be spending 1%.
Yeah, so the EU average is 1.6%. The comparison to the other two kind of military neutral, to use your own phrase, countries is Malta at 0.4%, Austria at 0.9%. We can increase our military spending. We need to, as we've laid it out, there's kind of three defence mechanisms in terms of ambition levels. We're currently aiming for the second one, which is looking to double that at the very least in the initiative. And what is that spending on? That spending is on the ICT infrastructure to make sure that we don't get another cyber hack like we experienced a number of years ago. It's to make sure that we have the crew on vessels that can actually patrol our waters when it comes to undersea cables.
Jennifer Whitmore, can we afford not to do this, or can we afford to do this at the expense of, I don't know, hospital trolleys, classroom sizes?
Oh, you know, when we talk about Ireland's capacity to manage a range of different projects across a different range of needy portfolios, like, I think we have the capacity financially at the moment. I think it's clear that we are a very wealthy country, and we've, seen huge...
Sorry, to do what? To start buying naval vessels?
No. What I'm saying is that we have a lot of money, and it's where we spend it is the issue. So I think we do. I think a conversation will be welcome, because I think what we've seen is this sort of drift from government towards more. Not having those transparent conversations but actually that there's been a drift towards it. So it's not, I think the conversations haven't been strategic. I think they haven't been transparent and clear. And I think, you know, there certainly wasn't any discussion about it before the election.
I think it was quite clear in our manifesto to lay out our aims in defence. And as Harry referenced, we had three very, very well attended public seminars. But what we got, and respectfully, this is not you who I'm aiming this at, but all we got from the opposition is whenever we say defence, it's a rush to NATO and the great militarisation of our nation. We actually want to have the mature conversation, I think you do too, and I'm happy to engage with you on it, that it also isn't a binary question. We do want to invest in our health infrastructure, but there's no point investing in our health infrastructure if we don't invest in the security mechanisms to protect that from modern forms of hybrid warfare, but don't necessarily come from state actors. Let's have that conversation.
Okay.
Let's have it openly.
Elaine Loughlin, on the one hand, when was the last time that Ireland's neutrality allowed Ireland to broker some international peace deal? But on the other hand from that... you've got to get real about the world that we live in.
And I think it's a lightning rod issue. And we've spoken about St. Patrick's Day. I think you could put neutrality into that, because I think a lot of people see our neutrality as they see hurling, as they see our literature, our culture. It is part of who we are. And I think we're very proud of being a neutral nation for very good reasons. And we have a long and complicated history.
But what has it done in the last two or three decades that's of any meaningful consequence?
But that's a question I think that Neil might be able to answer. But I think we do have to have conversations around this, because while we do put a lot of store in our neutrality, I think when Neil and other ministers go across to Europe, they're hearing a very different message. And Micheál Martin Taoiseach, to me, described it as Ireland being blissfully unaware of what's happening on the continent. Now, when you have countries increasing their spend on defence by around 4 to 5%, and taking money out of social protection to fund defence measures. Now, I'm not saying by any stretch of the imagination that Ireland should be doing that, but there is a real and palpable fear on the continent of Europe around the threat of Russia. And I think when ministers go abroad to the continent of Europe, they're hearing that. They come back here and the conversation is around protecting our neutrality, and perhaps, you know, you're fear-mongering, you're scaremongering, and we shouldn't be doing this. On the other hand as well, you have the military and the defence forces who are crying out for funding, because they don't have, as Harry said, they don't have the numbers sometimes to even put a vessel in the water. And even we saw the Golan Heights peacekeepers mission stop there because we didn't have the troops to fill those positions.
All right, stay with us. Elaine Loughlin, Harry McGee, Jennifer Whitmore and Neil Richmond. Be back after this break.
Email todaycb@rte.ie.
I want to turn to rent pressure zones now. And the story in the Irish Times that we talked about a little bit earlier on, the Residential Tenancies Board has flagged 16,000 cases where the RPZ restrictions may have been broken. Neil Richmond, In the midst of a housing crisis, it appears that landlords are flouting government rules on an absolutely vast scale with relative impunity.
No, there's very real fines and punishments in place that can be put in place and that this government put in place to make sure, because we take it very serious. And the report is stark. And
Is the RTB in a position, is it resourced to prosecute 16,000 cases?
Well, if the actual number is 16,000, obviously that's the presumption. I believe they are. And one message that I really want to go out to renters who are in a reason that they might need to, do go to the RTB. It's not as intimidating a place as it is. You don't need a solicitor. It's generally an online situation. It's a really, really important service put in place to make sure that renters are protected. And there are very real, meaningful fines for landlords who
are
breached.
How confident would you be today of going to the RTB and getting any redress if you lived in an RZP and or rent pressure zone, rather, and your landlord had jacked up your rent? In the knowledge that there are 16,000 people in the queue ahead of you to get redress.
Let's get the exact number first. But no, I would be confident because I've been dealing with the RTB, as is Jennifer and any other public representative, for years. And it's always led to, in the vast majority of cases, a really good, decent resolution in the finding towards the renter. In this party, it's a good process. It's a fair process. If it needs extra resources to make sure it can fulfil its mandate, there's no shortage of desire of government to make sure it has it.
Elaine, you spoke to the Taoiseach in last Saturday's Examiner and you broke the news that he's considering scrapping the rent pressure zones. Are they effectively now at an end, with between him signalling his political intention and the news that the 16,000 landlords who already are flouting the rules?
Mm-hmm. And it does seem like the government is about to make significant changes, not just to the rent pressure zones, but in Harry's paper this week as well, there was a mention of tax breaks for developers, which I think will certainly spark emotions in some people, given our recent history and the crash. But It is something that you kind of wonder, these 16,000 landlords who effectively we can assume have broken the rules. Now, some, as has been stated on your programme earlier on today, may have been for very solid reasons. You know, the house may have been done up or they may not have increased the rent for a number of years. But I think it comes back to the funding of the RTB and the supports and the systems that are in place for the RTB, because they have been underfunded and understaffed for many years and can't deal with, I think, the volume of complaints that are coming in. So encouraging more people to complain, I think, is something that members working in the RTB won't be too happy to hear this morning.
Jennifer Whitmore.
I rented for many, many years, I think probably 20 years. And when you're renting, you feel incredibly vulnerable. Incredibly vulnerable. You're constantly waiting for the letter to come through the door to tell you that your rent is going up or that your landlord is selling and you're gone from the house. And that was how I felt. Now, this was 15 years ago was the last time I rented. I would imagine for people who are renting in the current climate, I'd say they are terrified to even ask the landlord to make changes, you know, to actually make changes around the house when, you know, if something goes wrong. Like, they would be absolutely fearful to go to the RTB in case they were put out on their ear. And I think that's...
So if an RPZ is an impediment to inward investment that's going to build more houses and ultimately bring rental prices down, shouldn't they go?
I think one of the issues with Micheál Martin coming out last weekend and saying this was he said it off the cuff. There had been no indication in the manifestos that this was going to be an issue. And he just sort of said it as an aside. Now, what he has done is frighten the life out of hundreds of thousands of people who are renting. 83% of renters are in rent pressure zones. So people heard the Taoiseach very sort of briefly mention something that could potentially impact their lives hugely. There's no follow-up detail. The idea of setting it, you know, having a different scheme where you're setting it to the rents in the area, something like that would take years, I would imagine, to get right, to get in place. So he's sort of very lightly introduced something into the discussion that I don't think he should have, that, and I think it was irresponsible of him to do it without having any backup, any ideas of what he was going to do, any firm plans. What he's done is frighten the life out of people.
Harry McGee, whether he's right or whether he's wrong as to whether the RPZs are an impediment to inward investment, has the government opened the door to a whole world of political pain here if in a couple of months' time people's rents do start making quantum leaps up?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the facts will follow the actual policy in that instance if it does happen. But there are a couple of things just to try to kind of put a bit of context to it. Now, in fairness to the rent, the RTB, it has prosecuted tenants, landlords who have raised the rents by levels above the 2% or the rate of inflation, whichever is
but
lower.
But 16,000 in one go.
Yeah, but they have scraped back. This was a survey that they did themselves, so they were proactive in this. They went out and they tried to find out how many landlords were non-compliant, and it's a considerable number. There's a debate, and I take Jennifer's point that the reference rent is a complicated arrangement, but it seems to be the standard arrangement in most other countries. Right.
The reference rent is to look at all of the other properties
in the locality. So the RCB started off in 2016 with four or five places, Dublin, Cork, essentially. Now it's in 19 of the 26 counties. There are 65 RZPs. The latest one was Sligo Drumcliff, which was added only in November or December of 2024. And it's a broad brush kind of a response, and perhaps it doesn't take in the subtleties that might pertain to particular areas. You can understand why it might work in Dublin, but in some of the rural areas, it might not be quite as effective a tool in relation to stimulate, to making sure that tenants are not being ripped off. But I think he said he's going to review it. I don't think he said he's going to scrap it entirely. And the funny thing, they've rejected a lot of what the Housing Commission recommended, or some of its key recommendations. I think the rent reference, if I'm not mistaken, was something that the Housing Commission did recommend as an alternative to the rent pressure zones.
And just to be absolutely crystal clear, the programme from government clearly commits to a review. So this is no off-the-cuff remark. This has been down in black and white for quite some time now. It's quite clear that a review of the rent pressure zone, yes, recommended by the Housing Commission, is necessary. It's been in place a long time. It's morphed into something much greater than it was.
OK, but the bigger picture here is, are you not doubling down or doing double or quits on a policy that hasn't delivered houses? Let's leave it to the market. Let's leave it to the large institutional international investors.
Well, I don't think reviewing a rent pressure zone suggests that. What we've said, Philip, quite clearly is we have no ambition in introducing or changing anything that will lead on the first hand to increased rents or higher levels of inaffordability.
Okay, what but Taoiseach signalled that his reason for reviewing it or revisiting it was that it wasn't something that was liked by international investors.
The review was stated in the programme for government long before the interview. It's quite clear there's government policy. We need to look at the review. Okay.
Why don't we ask the person, person who was in the room, what she thought that he meant when she said it?
Well, I think the Taoiseach did say that the review will go ahead, and there is time because the rent pressure zones are in place until the end of the year.
But was he doing it in response to pressure from international investors?
He did make the point that we do need to make Ireland a lucrative place, or a place that investors, pension funds, would want to come to invest, because those type of entities, whether we like them or not, are required. And he also mentioned the fact that the Housing Commission has put forward this alternative of the rent references. Okay. Now, to me, when a politician, especially a Taoiseach or a minister, says they're going to review something and then they signal an alternative, I think they're pretty far down the road in changing what is there at the moment.
And I think, you know, like Neil mentioned, that they wouldn't do anything that would push up rents. I don't understand how, you know, the government can expect people to believe that, because over the last term of the government, rents went up by 38%. You know, so the history of the previous government shows that actually your policies are putting up rents for people, and they're continuing to do so. And in relation to the lucrative nature and you know, whether the poor investment funds aren't getting enough money, I mean, they went from paying 74 million in tax to 32 million in tax around the same time that Pascal Donoghue had said that they were implementing very aggressive tax strategies and he was going to review it and stop it. So This is a very lucrative business for investment funds. But I think what's happened is that the government's back is against the wall. It's clear that their housing plan isn't working. It's clear that the figures that they were putting out before the election, they were incorrect. And so the government was painting a very, very different picture from the reality on the ground. And the their back is up against the wall now. And what they're doing is they're going to their normal way of dealing with this, their normal MO, and that is to give tax breaks to the investment funds. Now, the Social Democrats are bringing a motion to the floor of the Dáil next week that will address this, and we'll see. We'll be putting forward a number of solutions. There are other ways of dealing with this. There are other ways of working and making sure that the housing market and availability take and affordability of people are
and other ways might
not
be
working.
And other ways might be take the Apple billions, take those corporation tax receipts while they're still there, Neil Richmond, and embark on public house building.
And we absolutely will. And we've made a quite clear commitment that we will. And we've quite clear that not just the Apple money, the corporate tax receipts, but also the windfall from AIB shares. We know the key issue here is we don't have enough homes. We actually beat our housing targets in the 3 years in entirety. But we do accept we need more homes. I don't
That's
know if Jennifer...
That's a very peculiar spin on the numbers of houses that were
numbers.
Built last
you
year.
You do it over 3 years. But my big point is I don't know if Jennifer's motion is going to build one more home or make one more rental property available. We are prepared to look at everything to do it, and that includes looking at the rent pressure zones and much else.
Harry?
Yeah, well, I'd agree completely with what Elaine said. I mean, when a politician thinks he's going to do a review of something and then point to an alternative, you know, you just join the dots. I mean, I think the RPZ will probably go. And I think I would take Jennifer's point that the alternative is quite complicated and may create more problems than it solves. But we'll just have to wait and see.
Okay. All right. Thank you all very much. Harry McGee, Elaine Loughlin, Jennifer Whitmore and Neil Richmond for joining me today. Have a good weekend, all of you. And indeed, have a good weekend, all of you who are listening. Thank you for tuning in today. You can catch up on anything you might have missed on this morning's show on the RTE Radio app. Today's programme was produced by the series producer, Niamh Lyons, researcher, Emma Cawley, broadcast coordinator, Jarlath Holland and on sound, Niall McMonagall. Now, coming up to midday, here's Louise.